A funny thing happened after the Egyptian soccer star Mo Salah joined the Liverpool Football Club.
Anti-Muslim tweets dropped by nearly half among Liverpool fans compared to fans from other groups.
How group identities can bridge religious, racial, and political divides, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Monday at 8 Central, 7 Mountain.
This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, how our brains are wired differently and how that can have dramatic impacts on our physical and mental health. But we are going to start today with the changing nature of work. Quaylen Ellingrud is a senior partner at McKinsey & Company, a global management consulting firm, and she recently spoke at the 2021 Faith, Reason, and World Affairs Symposium at Concordia College. Her topic, Making a Living and Making a Life, What Every College Student Needs to Know About the Job Revolution. Quaylen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
I was going through the list of presenters at this symposium, and your name stuck out to me for several reasons, one of which is that you have this focus on the pandemic's impact on the changing nature of work and specifically how it is impacting women. And so I don't even really know how to start with such a broad topic because I don't want to say, so how is COVID changing the nature of work? But for somebody who studies work and our approaches to work, when something that is major, like a world war or a pandemic, happens, what are the first indicators that you would look for how this is going to affect the economy?
Absolutely. I would first look at employment rates and who is leaving the workforce. I think in September, last September of 2020, just as schools were reopening and many of them were going back in hybrid form, the United States saw 1.1 million people either getting fired or stepping out of the workforce. And of those 1.1 million people, 80% of them were women. And so we saw right away as schools were reopening that this pandemic was going to be quite different than typical. Mm. It was going to be much more disproportionately affecting women in their roles, not just as mothers and being sort of temporary school teachers and helping children with remote learning, but also cooking at home much more than we ever had due to safety concerns. In fact, we found that mothers, about 40% of them during the pandemic, took on an additional 15 hours or more every week, right? So a very healthy part-time job in addition to their original workloads compared to about 27% of fathers. So a pretty disproportionate impact.
Wow. It's not often that I get caught speechless in an interview, but an extra 15 hours a week, like you said, that is absolutely a part-time job. How much of this disproportionate impact on women is because of the types of jobs that women held were more likely to be cut? And how much of it is women were the ones who stepped away from work because of the caretaking, the schooling, the parenting?
Yeah, you're right. It's a mix of both. So women tend to be concentrated in certain occupations that were very much disproportionately affected by COVID. So accommodation, travel and hotels, for example, mm-hmm. Customer service and sales was significantly impacted. Food service, right? Waiters, waitresses, bartenders, all of those tend to be about two-thirds women, one-third men, compared to things like construction, right, which was much more male-dominated. So the occupations that women held certainly explained a lot of it, but I think something like 25% of it was not explained by occupations, was not explained by full-time versus part-time work. and was in fact, you know, women really bearing a disproportionate responsibility during the pandemic for kids, for cooking, for other unpaid care work activities.
The jobs that you mentioned that were cut right away, the restaurants, the events businesses, I'm wondering, 18, 24 months into this pandemic, are we seeing different industries disproportionately impacted now, farther down the line?
There has been kind of an immediate drop, as you described, and then a slower recovery, and some industries, some occupations have recovered much more quickly than others. What we see overall is we expect the job market on average to recover by the third quarter of next year, so about a year from now overall. But to your point, right, some cities, some states will recover slower or faster. So the state of Minnesota will recover job-wise in Q4 of 2022, so about a quarter after the overall country. And then the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul, will recover about a quarter earlier, so in Q2 of 2022. So it's not equal based on the occupation mix, the industry mix around the whole country.
What do employers need to be talking about, need to be addressing right now to get those women back into those jobs? I had a discussion a week or so ago about this idea that something like daycare access should be considered part of an infrastructure bill. We need roads to get to work, but we need daycares to be able to work. What do you want employers to be thinking about?
I think employers are increasingly thinking about flexibility and support for their employees as they think about the return to the workplace. Unfortunately, what we've seen, as many companies have said, you know what, we're going to open up our offices and allow you to come in as you want, sort of an optional return to work. We've seen a couple of different trends that I think are worrisome, both for women, for minorities, and for people with care responsibilities. We've seen most of the people coming in being, you know, skewing younger, sometimes skewing single men without children, or people without care responsibilities have been felt more free to come into the office. We also see a trend where it's not just the company-wide policy about return to the workplace, but it's also that individual leader. So for example, if a CFO, you know, even with the same company policy, comes in every single day and you can see them on Zoom or Teams in their office at work, but the head of HR doesn't and sets a very different tone, then most of the people in finance try to come into the office, and most of the people in HR feel comfortable not necessarily coming into the office. So the individual tone that each leader sets is also quite important. And so making sure that we're inclusive, allowing people to be flexible as they need, given this next period will still be one of a lot of change and juggling a lot of different considerations, I think will be quite important.
I want to talk about this idea of productivity as a metric and how we measure this and some maybe older school approaches to productivity is this idea of butts in seats. And if you are here for 40 hours, you know, then I can count you as being a productive employee, whereas other people at home might have something as simple as the temperature is not too hot or too cold. They're more comfortable at home and therefore able to work more productively. How do you look at how we measure productivity?
Absolutely. It was interesting because when the pandemic first happened, a lot of CEOs and other leaders did ask, well, how will I know if my employees are being productive? And I said, exactly as you described, well, how did you know they were being productive before? Right? I certainly hope it wasn't by watching them in their desks, at their desks and in front of their computers, because who knows what they're actually doing. And so what I think we've seen throughout the pandemic is actually a factual and, you know, very closely studied increase in productivity. But I want to make sure that we don't sort of underestimate the cost at which that productivity has come. There has been incredible stress, a lot of pressures, right? Much higher mental health concerns and stress across the United States. And so that has resulted, I think, in longer hours. Yes, in pockets, greater productivity. Some of that has come at the expense of, you know, what used to be commuting time to work. You know, you no longer need to commute, so you can spend some of that time working.
Oh, right.
but there has been a real trade-off, I think, in terms of mental health and stress levels there. We don't think we're starting to see that productivity bump that we saw during COVID sort of slowly decrease. You know, historically, interestingly, productivity has been stubbornly constant across decades. And productivity, the way we measure it globally and in the United States, is often sort of GDP per capita times the number of employees that you have working. And if you look back historically in the United States, productivity has remained stubbornly constant. And I would have expected it to increase, right, when we had the internet boom and all of a sudden things were happening in online marketplaces much more efficiently than before. Why didn't we see productivity increase? In fact, the main times we have seen GDP per capita rise in the United States is when more workers entered the workforce. So between World War II and today, one of the biggest drivers of standard of living increase is more women in the workforce, more dual career couples than we have had before. And that drives, you know, better standards of living in the United States. That's driven much more of it, frankly, than productivity increase, which I would argue, given what we've seen in COVID, I don't know how sustainable at least this current bump in productivity is. I'd want to make sure that as we have future productivity improvements, they're done in a sustainable way that don't stress out employees, that don't increase kind of mental health concerns.
What do we lose when we take women out of the workforce?
We lose so much. I think we lose diversity of thought. We know that diverse teams are better. They actually factually perform better in terms of economic and total returns to shareholders. We know diverse teams have a broader way of thinking and tackling problems. So a diverse team is not only better able to solve a tough problem because they're going to question each other's assumptions and how they come at the problem, but interestingly, they're also better able to be open to the idea that they didn't get the best solution the first time. So this notion of continuous improvement comes much more naturally to a diverse team than one that is quite homogenous. I think that's the diversity, not just, you know, diversity in terms of we want people who come from different backgrounds. We also want inclusion, right? We want those people to truly bring their full and authentic selves to the workplace so that we have that diversity of thought and we're getting to the better answers for teams, for companies, for customers.
Bringing a full and authentic self to the workplace, what are the main barriers to that right now?
There's a number of them. I think there is not enough diversity at all levels of the organization. So, for example, women make up less than a third of the C-suite of people reporting to CEOs across corporate America. Women of color, which is Black, Latina, and Asian women all added together, make up 4% of the C-suite, right? So literally one out of 25 people reporting to a CEO in the United States is either Black or Latina or Asian all added together. And that level of representation just doesn't allow you to both be there and be part of the decision-making and bring your full and authentic self. In addition to representation gaps, I also think we have inclusion gaps. So challenges around microaggressions, right? The small paper cuts at work around, you know, surprise at your verbal abilities or making a joke or, you know, appropriating an idea that you share to somebody else in the meeting. Those kinds of things are day-to-day small challenges, but they do add up over time and result in a lack of inclusion.
And those numbers, they didn't even include Indigenous people.
No, they did not. And we're looking to get deeper data on Indigenous populations. Unfortunately, it's typically such a small portion of the population across corporate America that it's quite hard to get into that level of detail, and that's something that we're working on.
We're visiting today with Coylin Ellingrude. She is a senior partner with McKinsey & Company, recently spoke at a symposium at Concordia College about making a living and making a life, what every college student needs to know about the job revolution. So I guess we should get to that. How do you tailor your message specific to college students?
Absolutely. And I have three daughters of my own, not quite close to college, but hopefully we'll be headed there eventually. I think a couple things I would say to college students today. I think there are so many skills that are shifting, right? In the future, we need much more technological skills, not just coding, but how do you interact effectively with technology? And we also need a lot more social and emotional skills. Mm. And so make sure in your education and the experiences that you're building and going through that you're prioritizing those elements as well, right? How do you build empathy? How do you understand what it's like to walk in somebody else's shoes? I also think this notion and love of learning that Concordia emphasizes is so important. How do you be adaptable? How do you continuously learn? How do you be open to different experiences? I think will make you a well-rounded person, friend, but also over time, a worker. And I hope maybe finally that each of you, as you think about what you want to major in and ultimately choose a vocation for your life, that you'll not only choose something that you love, but something that we will need a lot more of, that the world needs a lot more of in the future. And hopefully you can find something that both satisfies your learning, but also creates impact, value, a better world for all of us. So those would be some of my advice for college students today.
What are you seeing? What are the trends predicting on these are the kinds of jobs we're going to need 10, 20, 50 years from now, if we can even predict out that far, given how quickly technology changes?
Absolutely. You know, we can predict out our current estimates are about 10 years out or so. And the job categories, the occupations that we see growing the most are very much health related, STEM related, transportation related jobs. So health aides, healthcare workers, health professionals, STEM professionals, but also transportation services. And we see other categories of jobs actually shrinking quite a bit. Things like assistance, customer service and sales, production, manufacturing, food service, mechanical installation categories are also shrinking.
How much of this, of the jobs that are predicted to be surging in the next decade or so, when we look at higher education, for so long there was this push for a four-year liberal arts degree, and some would even say to the detriment of the two-year hands-on technical degrees, that the pendulum almost kind of swung too far. What are you seeing in terms of the types of higher education that we need to accommodate the changing workforce?
I think that is getting much more flexible in very exciting ways. And a number of large companies in the U.S., IBM, Hilton, Google, not that long ago said, you don't need a four-year degree to work at our company. In fact, we are revamping and rethinking our interview process to test your skills. And those could be skills that you built on the job, added to your institution or vocational school, or have sort of built, you know, over the years. So not needing a four-year degree necessarily, but really needing the skills and the applied capabilities to do the work is what we're seeing a lot more of.
You talked earlier about World War II, and one thing that interests me about that event and its impact on the economy is there was this wage stagnation. There was this rule that you couldn't attract workers by increasing their wage. And then that's where things like a benefits package, we're paying for the health insurance or having better vacation policies came out of, kind of like when all of the big airlines a long time ago, New York to LA, it was the same price no matter what airline, and then they competed on best food in first class or what have you. What do you hope will come out of a pandemic in terms of just looking at something completely differently?
I think along the same lines as you were just describing post-World War II, better care, family paid leave, for example. Only 4% of companies today offer stipends or some sort of support for childcare. I hope that that will increase from 4% to a much higher number. I think mental health benefits and support, kind of more holistic support and flexibility for workers, would be a huge step in the right direction. In some of our recent data, 70% of employees said, if I can't work flexibly from home at least one day a week, that will be a top criteria in choosing my next job. And we've already started to see what we're calling the great attrition, right? Lots of employees leaving, and about a third of the employees leaving these days don't even have another job to go to. They're simply saying, my current job is not working for me. I want a different direction in life. I have confidence I will find another job, but this path is not what I want anymore. And so we have never really seen that level of attrition with really no other option in hand. It's quite surprising. So we are seeing spikes in attrition in a lot of different areas. And some of that may be finally this geographic barrier being lifted on jobs and employment, right? So now if I live in Maine or wherever it might be, the next day I can click on a Zoom link or a Teams link and start to work for another company. I don't actually have to move my entire family. Some of that flexibility being lifted is causing a much more intense war for talent for great leaders, I would say diverse leaders, as well as really hard to find talent. So areas like advanced analytics and digital talent are seeing a lot more proactive offers and a lot more flexibility of, you know, you don't have to move to our headquarters. We'll figure it out.
Yeah, in real estate, you know, you can have it be a buyer's market or a seller's market. And it sounds like in the job, in the economy right now, it's really workers' rights.
Yes, it is a seller of talent market.
You know, I read a report out of Alabama recently that for the first time in history, they were reporting more deaths than births. And I know this is a little bit outside the scope of the conversation, as I pointed out at the beginning, but I'm wondering, what do death and birth rate statistics mean for the changing nature of work?
Yeah, I think it helps us think about the future skills that we'll need, right? So birth rates today help us think about what are the skills we're going to need to build over a child's lifetime until they're, whether that's 16, 18, 20, 22, and ready to enter the workforce. I think it's a real challenge now because the pace of change is so much greater in terms of occupations that are shifting, parts of jobs that are being affected by automation. You know, 60% of our occupations are going to have at least 30% of the work being able to be automated away over the next 10 years. And so the pace of change for a child born today to the skills that they're going to need to enter the workforce productively in, let's say, 20 years is going to be quite different. So how do we keep pace with the upskilling, reskilling, educational needs that the children born today are going to need? It's quite a challenge at a scale that we have not yet encountered.
Quaylen Ellingrud is a senior partner for McKinsey & Company, a global management consulting firm. She spoke recently at the Concordia College Faith, Reason, and World Affairs Symposium on the topic, Making a Living and Making a Life, What Every College Student Needs to Know About the Job Revolution. She has written for Time and the Harvard Business Review and spoken at the UN Women's Empowerment Principles event, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Wilson Center for the U.S. Treasury, and the U.S. EEOC. Quaylen, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchet, realtor and broker with Hatch Realty, serving home buyers and sellers in the Fargo-Moorhead Metro, Grand Forks, Bismarck, Mandan, and Detroit Lakes area. Josh can be reached at 701-369-4839 or hatchrealty.com. Prairie Public is proud to be the media sponsor of the FM Visual Artists Studio Crawl, October 2nd and 3rd, noon to 6 p.m. See Fargo-Moorhead's artist at work. Ask questions and perhaps be inspired to create your own art. Find a map to begin your tour at prairiepublic.org.
This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and now a fascinating discussion on neurodiversity. The fact is our brains are wired differently, and that can have pretty dramatic impacts on our physical and mental health, especially if you're one of those people whose brains is neurodiverse instead of what they call neurotypical. We're going to learn all about those words and much more from John David Burdall and Heather Zinger. They are the co-hosts of the web series and a podcast, Where Are You From? Burdall says it's a question he gets asked regularly, but it's not really the question people want to be asking.
Because I come off really, quirky, unconventional, as we're going to talk about atypical. Mm-hmm. You know? And so they're just not used to it. And so they just kind of look me over. You know, they kind of size me up. And it's like, so where are you from? You know, and that's what I get asked. And I do answer. I take it literally because I'm, you know, wired to be very, very literal. And then I answer, you know, I'm from Fargo, Moorhead, or, you know, I'm just from a couple blocks away.
Sure.
And they're not satisfied with that answer. You know, and that's when they weren't being satisfied by that answer. And that's when I really started to like look at, why am I being asked this? You know, and so often where I live, you know.
Yeah. And you just said, because I'm wired to be literal. Yeah. So what we're talking about is some brain wiring right now. Because you have Asperger's syndrome.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that is what people are really getting at when they're saying, where are you from? Mm-hmm. In the podcast, you have this clip that it's really, why are you so different from me?
Yes. Yes. But they don't know how to ask that, you know, in such a way that, you know, without perhaps, I don't know, aggravating or agitating or, I don't know, of maybe eliciting some sort of response that would be uncomfortable or, you know, I don't really know. I don't really think about it too much. I hadn't really thought about it too much.
Okay.
Like how difficult it could be for some people to try and find out why someone is different from them. It doesn't even like occur to me now. I'm talking about it now, but I'm like, I don't know what I'm supposed to say. I don't know how I'm supposed to say this. You know, often I'm very articulate.
But sure.
Like, I don't.
But I'm just me.
I'm out of my area when I'm there, you know, or trying to think like that. And so I did in an episode, finally just try and answer that question.
Yeah.
You know, why am I so different from you? And yeah, I'm on the spectrum, you know, and I interpret sensory input. I interpret the world, you know, in a very different way. You know, in a very unique way.
Well, let's talk about that sensory input. How is it that you describe how you are processing all the information that comes at us in a way that sets you apart from other people?
Okay. Well, so how I do describe it to some people is that I'm a stranger in a strange land. I'm going from kind of general and I'll go to specific. Okay. Mm-hmm. So stranger in a strange land or a foreigner, you know, in your country. I don't know all your customs and I don't know all your, you know, what some words that you're saying. And that just happens with people, you know, people trying to communicate, you know, or talk to people or whatnot. But yeah, as I get to now specific, it's like certain sarcasm even now, it's like I don't like it, just looks so bizarre to me. You know, or if a person is smiling while crying, you know, it's like I'm doing it right now, it's like I don't understand what I'm seeing, even though logically or perhaps intellectually I've had it explained to me intrinsically. You know, it's like this is not making any sense whatsoever. Like, yeah, I'm getting nods in the room. So it's like, this is really, thank you for acknowledging that. That's really nice of you. Because some people just will say, will you just be quiet when I'm trying to ascertain what's going on? You know, and I'm not calling those people mean, but, you know, it's like I'll try and ask, like, so what does that mean that this person is crying and smiling? You know, is the person sad or is the person happy?
Right.
You know, and so I'm attempting to, discern and interpret all of that kind of dissonance.
Yeah.
You know? And I've put in the work now. I was diagnosed at 30. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah. So I spent 3 decades in another dimension. That's what I tell people. And again, to be specific, it's like all of this is happening, but not one person had sat me down and explained why it was happening. You know?
Right.
And they didn't know that they were supposed to. They just presumed I would get it. you know, like perhaps typical people do. It's just like, well, this is school because it is school. Okay, I'll just be here, but I don't. And so academically, I did really well because I was told to. So I just did.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, and people with Asperger's tend to have higher than normal IQs as well. It's more so the emotional intelligence and those cues that is a different processing speed.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And it's a bit slower.
It sounds exhausting.
It can be. It can be. But since this has been my world, I just, I don't know, coped with it and got acclimated to it and got used to it. And now we had been talking. It's like, and so now it's my superpower to really figure out what's going on. And I have a really associative and connective mind, you know, and I can see, you know, pieces. I can see everything that's going on and I start to put it together, you know, in a way that's supposed to make sense to me. And then often when I do that, people will say, wow, that really makes sense to me. You know, it's like that makes better sense to me the way you put this together. And by that, I mean a web series. Okay, like just putting together a web series. I just did it because I was getting asked all the time, where are you from? So I was like, I'll just put together.
I'm just going to make this easy.
I'll just answer the question that way. And it's like, and people are like, this is phenomenal. And I'm like, well, that's great. Because I don't have that relationship to my feelings that other people do. I don't, it's called alexithymia, to be specific, really, really specific. And I don't have a concrete sense of self. I don't know what emotional state I'm in. You know? Being alive, you know, just being here. And
conversation we're having on the way over here is John's driving, right? So we all know we're a little bit more focused when we're driving, as we should be.
Sure.
And we were having this conversation. I can't remember all the things. I'm not going to go into that unless you want to, John.
But I can remember it, and I have an eidetic memory.
Yeah. Right, and this is mine. My memory is not great. My working memory is also a function of the ADHD. That is not wonderful and something I have to adapt to. But I saw and experienced a little bit more intensity. So stronger speech, maybe a slight rise in the voice, all this stuff. And I'm watching that. And for me, this means something. But I was like, wait a minute, John, I'm observing this, but I don't really know if what I'm observing and what I think that means is matching your experience. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about this.
Sure.
And what did you, what was your response?
I was just giving what I was getting. I was mirroring. Like, so, and not to say, oh, I'm not responsible for any of my behavior. It's like now I know that when I'm around certain people, like even in this room right now, I realize I'm speaking softer. Because we're all speaking softer. I'm just doing it, you know.
Okay.
And I have enough, and I had called it intentional focus, to know, oh, that's why I'm doing that. You know what? I'll keep doing it.
Uh-huh.
You know? Because, you know, the group is doing it, you know. And so that's what was going on in the vehicle. She was, you had admitted you were sort of nervous, you know. And it's like,
oh, because we have, I mean, we talk about a lot of things.
Sure.
But I was like, let's just check in about this real quick.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And then we talked about there being skills, like real skills that you, when you say that you're intentional in how you're doing some of this mirroring, was skills learned.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Like noting that something is going on, you know, I can talk about that. And then really allowing something to continue, but also, listening to or paying attention to nonverbals, you know, and also verbals, you know, hearing how another person is feeling. And then, I'm driving, but also, you know, it's kind of like, okay, there are a lot of gestures. I notice that with people. It's like, I have to do that. That's the work that I have to do you know, the focus that I have to have. I have to just kind of look at a person and study. And as I had said, if a person is crying and smiling or, I don't know, being physically sort of like really, really animated, but saying, no, I'm perfectly calm. It's like,
it's fine. It's fine. It's just on fire.
Exactly. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, I'm out of my element here. You know, and I start to admit that to people.
Yeah.
I do not understand what's going on right now. You know, I don't get this.
And I have to step back.
I suppose so. Although for me, I just walk into the storm.
Oh.
Because that's how I found not having a sense of self. And I do hope, Heather, that you can talk quite a bit. Isn't it great how not having a personality monopolizes or like takes total, t- totally like hijacks a conversation. You know? Oh, really? You don't have like a tell me about that for hours, you know?
And I think what's interesting is we've already had a lot of this conversation of like your experience in that way.
Sure.
And that's why I love that you started this web series, is so that other people can be part of that conversation. And so when you watch the web series, it really, you know, the first season is John going through and laying some ground and, you know, you're getting this big introduction to John. And then we could talk about how I came to be a part of your web series quick if you want to.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, Heather, I want to play a clip because you come in season two of the Where Are You From podcast, and we are visiting with the co-hosts of that program, John David Berdahl and Heather Zinger. And Heather, in this clip, you are really frustrated about
is this
the banging on the table one. Yeah, about going through life with the neurodivergent brains that you have in a world that is neurotypical. And we're going to talk more about what that means, but I want to establish a little bit more what that feels like.
Mm-hmm.
And can we just take a moment to be like, okay, we both have diagnoses, we both have done our work, we both continue to do our work, and yet sometimes when it comes to certain neurotypicals, it's like, are you You could do some work! You could! And you need to! Stop making it hard!
Now, we're all laughing at this, and Heather, I've known you for a few years, and we have had several conversations about the work that you have put in to what it means to be Heather Zinger. And how I came across this interview idea is you had posted it on Facebook about joining this web series on being neurodivergent in a neurotypical world.
Mm-hmm.
What is neurodiversity?
Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important. Thank you for bringing that up, is to really, how are we going to frame this conversation that John and I are now having together?
Mm-hmm.
John coming from an autistic perspective, I coming from an ADHD perspective.
Mm.
And so I was going online to do research just because I'm like, you know, we can talk about it from our experience, but I want it to be a lot more like literal and articulate, which is not always my forte. But basically when people talk about neurodiversity, they're talking about a range of differences in individual brain function and behavioral traits. So these can include how people socialize, how they learn, how they pay attention, their mood, and other mental functions. Okay, this is the big thing. And it's in non-pathological ways that are regarded as part of a normal variation in the human population. So I'm not sure how much this audience or any audience really would be familiar with the whole territory and conversation between neurodiversity and the disability movement. They are two separate things, so there is overlap.
Mm.
And typically in neurodiversity, I should say typically, but in a more narrow focus, it relates to people with autism, ADHD, and those living with learning disabilities. Mm-hmm. However, since the neurodiversity came onto the scene and was defined, it has started to apply to other neurodevelopmental disorders and can include even certain things that would be considered mental health issues, such as schizoaffective disorder, sometimes OCD, sometimes personality disorders, because what it seeks to do is take a more social perspective. So it's not just a diagnosis that needs to be fixed and cured with medical intervention so that it never existed or so that you can then be
normal.
And neurotypical basically is about people who are non-autistic. They have non-autistic brains, okay? Essentially, to keep it clear and focused, that's what neurotypical means, right?
Okay.
Sure, yes, yeah. And I looked that up, like neuroatypical, what the definition of that was.
Please.
And then, well, the definition was someone who's not neurotypical.
Yes.
Thanks for the circular definition.
Not helpful.
Okay.
Just to say real quick, so neurodiversity was actually coined in 1998 by sociologists who also had autism.
Mm-hmm.
And her name, I think, is Judy Singer.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really started to take root first in the autism movement. And then it has since been enlarged and expanded to include other things. But medical experts, neurodiversity advocates, people in the disability movement, everyone's got different nuanced understandings, explanation around that. But that's kind of the territory.
Well, I want to talk to you about using, when you said the word normal, Heather, you used air quotes. Mm-hmm. And so the difference between calling something neurotypical and calling something normal, mm-hmm. calling you neurodivergent versus atypical or even worse, mm-hmm. abnormal. Mm-hmm. So can you talk to the power of using phrases like that?
Like neurodiversity and neurotypical?
Yeah, versus normal and abnormal.
Yeah, and sometimes I throw in the normals just because if people haven't had any experience or exposure mm-hmm. to different brains and what that means, and that's a thing, normal and not normal is going to make more sense to them. So it's really okay. Like, what audience are we talking to?
Okay.
But the purpose of bringing in neurotypical, neurodiverse, is to be like, now these are parts of identity. They're parts of being and interacting and behaving in the world that need to be named, need to be talked about. Ideally, society would enlarge enough to be accessible to all brain differences.
Mm.
So it really sets up this conversation for people who are living with these differences to have more autonomy, more empowerment, sometimes with the use or other assists. So like mm-hmm. Independent living assisting or different, let's say, amount of time you have for a test mm-hmm. or different, I don't know, accommodations based on mm-hmm. where the rub of the neurotypical world is rubbing it against their neurodivergent difference, right?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
How do we negotiate
right.
that so
yeah.
everybody can have access?
We don't judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree.
No.
I was just
right.
going
like
to say that out loud. I was going
excellent.
To. Yes, because that's really what it is. It's kind of like people demanding, yes, that this fish climb a tree. Yeah,
one way.
Like, yeah, do this. And then, yeah, I run into so many people who, or I mean, I had experiences in my life where people would say, like, why don't you – you're so gifted. You're so smart. And I talk about this on another mm-hmm. podcast that I work on. But it's like, why, you're so gifted. How do you not understand this? And it's like, I don't understand why I don't understand. I mean, at least there was a time when I didn't understand why I didn't understand.
Huh.
You know, and people would get mad and they'd call me names. Mm. And I was about to say, well, but I'm not going to – not right
yeah.
now. But, you know, and it was just not very respectful. It very – and, you know, it comes up where – and I say this to people. It's like if I'm asking people to accept me for who I am or at least who it is that I'm supposed to be, I have to at least try and understand or accept those people for who they do believe they're supposed to be, if they mm. do believe they have a prejudice or if they do believe they have a discomfort or a rage, really, a rage for anything that's different or anyone that's different. I'm not saying I condone it. I'm not wow. in any way saying I condone
yeah.
it, but – it's like, as I tell our parents, I had to tell them this. To understand my condition, I had to understand the human condition.
Mm.
And the human condition is that we don't – some of us do not understand, nor do they want to.
Mm.
You know? And it's like – so I'm not going to sit there and try and just hammer something into people like terms and
sure.
– you know, it's like – because they'll just be like, whatever. You know? So
yeah.
what I'm going to do is just make a difference.
Mm. Well, I wonder about this concept of being well adapted to a sick world is not really a metric for health.
No.
But you're living in a world where, Heather, I have known you to just fight passionately for access to the medication that you want, for treatment that you need, for counselors that can identify with you. John, you said you didn't get your diagnosis until you were 30.
Yeah.
And so I just want to talk to each of you about what would be the best advice that you would have for how to advocate for yourself as a patient. Heather, you can go ahead and go first.
And you can jump in because I think some of this may overlap.
Sure.
I know for me, from my brain, like, again, for, let's say, my ADHD brain, I need to see things. I need to experience them. I need to be engaged in order for things to stick in my brain.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to go find people who have things I think I might have and read about their experiences. So go find all the autobiographies of people who are living with ADHD or anxiety and depression. Go find it on NAMI.org, which is a website that's dedicated primarily to mental health conditions. I also go and look for different online groups listen to different mm-hmm. podcasts, really work on educating myself, because unfortunately, as I'm sure you've experienced, you know, we live in a smaller area. Mm-hmm. There are people who are either self-described experts on either autism or ADHD that it turns out not to be the case, yeah. or it turns out that they're lacking key components either because they don't live with it themselves, they haven't studied it extensively, or are new to their journey to understanding. Mm-hmm. And so there really is a lot of self-advocacy required. And the challenge is that for people who have certain levels of impairments, that self-advocacy is not possible. They do need assistance to get mm-hmm. that. And sometimes they'll get that and sometimes they won't. Mm-hmm. So I just want to make that aware. Like, I am able to advocate a lot for myself, but I have resources. Mm-hmm. I have economic and social resources. I have time. I can hold a day job. Mm-hmm. So I'm able to advocate for myself in certain ways. But you know, when I sit at the table and I beat my fist on the bench,
yeah.
sometimes it would just be nice if in every situation I come to, even with, medical professionals,
yeah.
I didn't have to explain everything or really fight to be seen, heard, listened to, understood, because how could you have problems? You look normal, in quotes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You look healthy.
Yeah. You've got great skin. Beautiful
right.
hair.
So how can I be like, no, I'm really struggling with some executive functioning deficits. I'm really struggling with some mood issues. Huh. I'm willing to do the work. How can I get support for this?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. So advocating, right, for
yeah.
ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I just started talking. It's not like I hadn't been talking, okay, before. A certain time or a certain mm-hmm. instance or something like that. But I was talking to a specialist, and this specialist, because I had been trying to figure out, okay, why is it that I don't understand the world the way that other people do? You know, why is it that I don't understand that that's a joke? Why don't I understand, you know, unless I'm told it's a joke, like verbally,
wow.
why don't I understand that there's a joke? Why don't I understand, you know, how something has changed,
yeah.
you know, or that something was going to change, you know? Why am I not understanding that, you know? The way other people do, and why are people needing to point out to me that I don't understand that? You know, and that was really the beginning of my journey, or my sort of, I guess, quest, or my trek. I better stop there. I was just trying to think of synonyms. I start to do that as soon as I think of a word. I start to envision,
Well, repetition is helpful for mm-hmm. self-soothing.
Yes, yes, it can be. You know, but for me, I just do it, I suppose, creatively, you know, because I know those words. I start to say them. You know? And that's one of the ways people would say, like, why do you do that? You know, like, why do you need to? And it's like, it's not a need. I just start because there are so many. You know, it's like, let's say them. You know? And then people are like, but you don't have to. You know?
Huh.
So, I was asking so many questions of counselors and doctors and clinicians and professionals, and I found a specialist who just had me talk and just say, start talking, you know, tell me about this, tell me about. And
yeah.
so that's my advice to answer the question, how do you advocate for yourself? Just
mm-hmm.
start talking. And if people tell you to be quiet, keep talking, okay? Keep trying to figure out, like, keep processing out loud, keep, you know, mm-hmm. Speaking, keep declaring, keep being vocal about what it is that you see, what it is that you hear, you know, what it is that's going on.
And, John, just to add to what you're saying is, mm-hmm. you know, we talk a lot about self
yeah.
and, like, how do we have a self and your experience of the self. And then in our most recent, we started season 3,
mm-hmm.
your phrase that you said is, I need a we
oh.
to be me.
Yeah, being a communitarian. Me needs a we to be.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah.
And so that ties into talking and engaging and
yes.
whatnot. Is that a way so you have that reflection of
yes.
what your self is, or can
yes.
you speak more to that?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, and that's how I did find out who I am, because people would tell me, oh, you're this sort of person. Oh, really? You know, it's like, and literally, like, I will walk past mirrors and I'll, like, startle myself. Like, whoa, like that. I don't retain what I look like.
Whoa.
You know, or what I sound like. And that's how far, I guess, my brain is going not. And it's not like it's hiding or I haven't been traumatized as far as I know. It's just it doesn't have that. I had said that the relationship that part of my brain has to another part of my brain is complicated. They're not speaking to one another. You know, but and that's something that occurs. And so how do I advocate for myself when I don't have a sense of self? And so that's – I just do it. you know, I don't know how to feel embarrassed. I don't know how to feel nervous. I don't know how to feel, at least in a typical way, if it's even there to begin with. Mm-hmm. But this specialist had said, just talk, you know, and it's like, and something that I hold on to too, and I do teach this in classes, is like, rarely do what you want, often do what you can, always do what you must, you know? And so I must talk about this. I must let people know, because there are some people who cannot talk about this the way I can, you know, who are nonverbal or they don't understand you know, yet that they can say something.
Well, you handed me a bracelet in the beginning of the conversation, and it says, never stop learning. And in the spirit of that, I just want to encourage people to check out the web series and the podcast. The web series is on YouTube. The podcast is on Spotify. It's called Where Are You From? We've been visiting with the co-hosts of the program, John David Berdahl and Heather Zinger. Thanks to you both for joining us today.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Ashley.
Hey, lifelong learner, Humanities North Dakota is featuring fear facer, speaker, and author Michelle Poehler live at the Bismarck Event Center. She has empowered thousands to step outside their comfort zone and tap into their full potential. Information and registration can be found at humanitiesnd.org.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative. Touchstone Energy Cooperatives comprise a nationwide network of over 730 consumer-owned electric cooperative utilities dedicated to community, integrity, accountability, and innovation.
Hi, this is Bill Thomas, Director of Radio at Prairie Public. Thanks to all of you who contributed in our September fundraising. Of course, you can still donate at prairiepublic.org or 800-359-4145. This September marks 40 years since the first Prairie Public radio station hit the air, and it's good to know our listeners still come through with the financial support that makes it all possible. We cannot do it without you. All of us here say thank you.
And we do want to offer our sincere, heartfelt thank you to all of those people who stood up and supported this service. We are so thankful to be able to do what we do every day. And we know it is possible because of you, our listener members. So please let me add on to Bill's thank you with one of my own. We simply couldn't do it without you. We'll, of course, be back on Monday with all of our regularly scheduled programming because of that membership support. Thank you. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.